Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of the Pocket Dojo podcast, the show where we talk about making the world a better place by making better things. I'm Paul Crick.
And I'm Asha Singh. We hope you had a good break over the Easter period and that spring is in full force, we're full bloom wherever you are, or indeed that the harvest of autumn is abundant and generous for you this year. Paul, what's in store for us on the show today?
Well, this week we're going to be talking about some useful frameworks for developing teams of the future.
So if you watched or listened to episode 8, that's the last one, you may remember we were looking at different kinds of teams, challenges they commonly face, and how Paul and I believe we need to develop teams of the future a little bit differently.
Yes, and in fact, we're coming to the end of the first series of the Pocket Dojo podcast. More about that later.
Great, let's get started.
Across the first series of the podcast, I've been introducing the GRACE framework to connect with self and others to develop emotional competence and build meaningful relationships. And in episode 6, we talked about the value of using a framework rather than a model when we want to develop ourselves, whether individually or together. A model is intended to represent reality, to provide some kind of certainty if we follow it properly. It's a tool that can become redundant quite quickly when the world changes very fast. Whereas a framework helps us look at what we're experiencing, to make sense of it, and to test our ideas against theories.
Yes, we might also find that reality doesn't fit the framework either. And then we need to be careful about not trying to make it do so through the stories we tell ourselves about what's real or possible or true. So in that case, we need to make intuitive leaps about what's going on and what we can do about it. These are essential capacities for responding effectively to complexity and uncertainty. And they go against a lot of what we've been taught about making things simple, linear, and easy to measure.
Absolutely. We try to keep things as stable and simple as possible and scale the things that work in one place in a completely different one, often creating a lot of unnecessary complexity in the process. We ignore the fact that living systems learn most when they are far away from stability, where they have to be creative and adapt to new situations that they experience.
Yes, we often don't consider ourselves or our organisations as living systems, whether they're a small startup working on social change or a community group or impact SME, or even a large traditional multinational corporate. We believe that we're machines that we need to compete and run as efficiently as possible in order to flourish. But if we really want to regenerate anything, whether that's leadership or business or economics or agriculture or the natural world or whatever, we really need to pay attention to the quality of the interactions and the relationships that we have between or among everyone involved and with the context or the places in which we find ourselves. Instead, we focus more on the quantity of what's produced or how we can maximize the leverage of something.
Indeed, we need to look at the spaces between us and how we navigate those, particularly when we have different worldviews and perspectives. What are some of the frameworks that might help us, Asha, so we can develop our teams and organizations in a way that make it possible for everyone to flourish?
I think there are quite a few, Paul. So let's introduce perhaps three here today that are useful for different kinds of things. Then we can look at others in series 2 of the podcast when we'll be exploring the spaces between us, as you just mentioned.
Great. So where's a good place to start?
Perhaps with the framework I shared briefly last week, which I'm calling Transform the Collective. I developed this a few years ago, distilling quite a lot of conversations with different people in different kinds of organizations and contexts, different places, into an illustration, let's say, of common landscapes, you know, particularly for organizations that are working in tech and impact, but not only. So I intended it as a map of what those landscapes are trying to address in order to develop new ways to organize themselves and do business, create healthy cultures and increase their impact, not just return on investment. So something to guide the direction of travel, you could say, when we're thinking about becoming more regenerative as an organization. So as you can see in the diagram, and excuse me looking down because I need to actually look at the diagram to describe it, there are two circles. The one on the left, the smaller one, is designed really, it shows the status quo, so how many organizations are today. And you can see some text in blue, which I'm going to go through in a moment, which is basically describing some of the characteristics of many organizations today. And on the right, we have a larger purple circle, which is representative of the new kind of organizations we might need to think about. And the parts in orange on the diagram are characteristics of that. So let me just describe those a little bit and why they're there. So, you know, going back to the idea that we feel we need to compete, we need to be machines that are running as effectively as possible, we have tried really, I think, as far as where we can, at least as organizations, you know, mature, to make them as robust and inert really as possible so that they are stable. That means having vertical structures and horizontal teams, for example, that work across different departments. And there's a real focus on efficiency. Now, I appreciate that not every organization is made like this, but this is a generalization, let's say, of what good business practice often has looked like till now. That means that we have mature sectors with and organizations who are also very competitive. Their cultures are really political. We think of value as being meeting the expectations of internal or external stakeholders. We don't really think about nature or the local community or whatever is being part of that stakeholder network, let's say. We have often quite traditional values in our organizations, business models and, you know, consequently business models and governance, forms of governance, which are obviously quite slow to adapt. And then we have often, you know, still expert leaders who drive top-down strategy that is, as I say, you know, focused on efficiency and incremental innovation. So that's of course, a generalization, but an illustration of the landscape of traditional business and organizations. And on the right, we have things which are starting to emerge, you know, particularly in certain sectors and maybe countries, cultures where these kind of values are already more acceptable and more common. So we have far more liberating, flat, tech-savvy networks. Obviously, you know, people and organizations working in those kind of arenas. The low granularity, so that means that people can make decisions quite locally. They don't need to go up and down, you know, vertical structures in order to do that. And there's a really strong focus on delivering value. So this kind of organization is much more adaptable and naturally resilient than obviously the traditional kind of ones. So they're also open, curious, they're experimental. They have to be or become excellent in business, product and service design and regularly reinvent themselves so that they can actually disrupt entire industries and sectors. And we can see that, you know, in a number of different places, which we'll come to maybe in a different episode. Leaders instead here are much more seen and empowered to be enablers. So they are there to create and in fact empower networks of cross-functional and just-in-time teams, something that we touched on last week, to make a deeper sense of life, to address systemic issues and make sure that the organization can innovate much more widely. So they're also often quite purpose-led. That means that they want to make an impact on certain things that they think are really important in society. And so deep trust and commitment are really important in those cultures. And they're created often through dialogue and alignment in that way, so that we can have more empowering models, business models, organizational models and forms of governance. And so value is created through collaboration across the supply chain and a really strong focus on customer relationship management in order to address global issues. So in other words, I think there's a change in what value or what is becoming valuable, I think is a quote from Laura Bateson, actually. What is becoming valuable in the world and what are the organizations that we need in order to make that value real?
That looks great as a big picture. As you say, a pointer for the direction of travel that could be useful. I'd like us to focus in, though, on a smaller scale with something concrete that teams could use to learn and navigate the spaces between them.
So as I've shared in previous episodes, I've done a lot of different work with different kinds of teams and organisations, and also in a few different countries. The second framework I'd like to introduce here is the distillation of all of that work really into what's called learning through doing. It's actually a process for developing collectively, and it's the name of my business. So as you can see in the diagram, learning through doing consists of three parts: step back, go deeper, and experiment and refine. Now, it would make sense to start at 1 o'clock with observed reality and then connect the dots, explore dynamics, see contributions, hold dialogue, elaborate purpose, signpost vision, way forwards, learn together, and create conditions for good things to happen. That would make sense, but in actual fact, you can start anywhere in this process. What's important is that we think about all these different things. So if I go to the elements, what that means, observing reality means that we're going to tell the story of what's been happening and our different interpretations of it. So I often work with teams and they start to elaborate the kind of narratives about their experience. They see both how different they are and how similar they are. In particular, once they connect the dots. So this is an opportunity to inquire why we're experiencing particular challenges, which rarely have a single cause. This helps us then to explore the dynamics that we're experiencing and illustrate, let's say, bring to the surface some of the thinking and behaviors that create those patterns. We don't do them intentionally, they just arise when we do certain things in certain ways. It would make sense then to go deeper and look at the contributions that we make to the reality that we experience. So it's not something that, life isn't something that happens to us. We need to investigate how we make sense of the world and if that worldview or that narrative is still serving us. Then we can start to hold dialogue. So that means a deeper kind of conversation where we play with how to deepen the glue that holds us together. And this helps us to elaborate meaning, shared meaning, just not just you or I or other people, but something that we can bring forth that's really important for all of us moving forward. So in other words, a point of common ground. We then need to experiment and refine because we might have to do very different things in different areas, particularly if we're a big team in a, you know, multinational organization in different countries and different contexts. So we need to signpost what might be next. We can't necessarily see where to go in a complex environment, but we can identify some first steps to take together. We need to learn together. So we need to share what we're learning about ourselves, one another, and the world around us through this process. And only then really are we ready to create some conditions, we could call them simple kind of ground rules, to agree on ways of working, governance, and business models that can produce the results that we want.
Very good. I can see how your process could be really helpful for teams who need some breathing space to look at themselves and to see what to do differently. What kind of teams have found this approach useful, and what kind of challenges have you used this approach for?
Actually, most of the teams we talked about last time, Paul, so cross-functional, multifunctional teams, multinational teams rather, who need to get to know each other and develop trust, particularly when they're under pressure and working remotely or perhaps hybrid in different kind of locations. So they were also looking for better ways to collaborate from sometimes really different perspectives, rather than pulling in different directions and competing for what, you know, they perceive as perhaps limited resources or opportunities. So in short, they had to remember that they work for the same organization and agree different ways to approach similar challenges. So that often means experimenting to see what works, you know, and adapt as we go along. And then I've also worked with quite a lot of teams actually, you know, other words, teams who bring together other groups of teams from different departments in a big organization so that they can solve really complex challenges. That's what I think of as developing real collective leadership. So in other words, where leaders need to become enablers, whatever the group requires, rather than driving their own functions to deliver something shared. So, you know, not surprisingly, that's what a lot of senior people find really challenging, because it's all about establishing and maintaining relationships across a wide range of areas. And that can be quite difficult when you've spent, you know, most of your professional life in the driving seat and chasing results. So it means creating conditions for good things to happen, which often won't be overnight. So, in short, it's actually all about regeneration. Which frameworks do you use for developing teams or team coaching, Paul?
Well, I think it's interesting because as I listen to you speak, we do similar work and use different frameworks, but essentially they do the same thing. So one of the ones I use is a leadership circle collective leadership assessment. And what that is a litmus test that assesses how good do we work together as a collective and how effective is our leadership in terms of achieving our goals. And essentially what we're looking at is we're looking at the creative structure. What are the creative structure of mind? What are the things that keep us to purpose and to vision? And what are some of the reactive tendencies we have? Some of the strengths that we overuse at times to try and control a situation or to try and placate certain groups of stakeholders or other parts of an organization. This is really helpful because what that does is it looks at what is the culture that we have now and what is the culture that we want to have in future. And what it does is it points to the gaps, or even where there are no gaps, it raises the question, so if there's no gap, what's the story that that's telling us? And the reality is that, as you point out in the description of some of the work that you're doing, it's about the quality of conversation. You know, the change in culture really comes from how we choose to tell the stories to ourselves and to each other. What are the patterns of language that we are using with each other, and how is that showing itself in our behaviors? What's good about that? What needs to change? And essentially, what I particularly like about it is there are some organizations that see the kind of work that we do as sort of light, fluffy, and a bit woolly and questionable, you might say. But I think that's an unfair criticism, because you've only got to look at the outcome and how people change, whether or not you use a data-driven approach like the collective leadership assessment, or we take an approach that is more intuitive, more creative, more emergent, and allows for things to evolve like the learning through doing approach. So I think the conclusion I'm arriving at is that what matters is the conversation you have once you've done whatever it is you're doing to say, what are the stories that we're telling ourselves? So that's one of the frameworks I like to use.
Yeah, fantastic. I'd like to ask you the same similar kind of question that you asked me just before, Paul. What kind of challenges, what sort of situations do you think that a data-driven approach like the collective leadership assessment is particularly useful? You know, are there particular teams or situations or challenges perhaps where you think that kind of approach is more useful?
I think it's for approach. What I found is with teams that are, I'm trying to find the right word, cynical's unfair, but hard-bitten, hard-driven, want numbers, I think it's really helpful because it lowers the waterline on that. You meet them where they're at. We're a numbers type organization. Give me numbers that show us what's going on. The reality is, right, is that they're self-reported subjective numbers that do have correlations that suggest relationships between certain ways of thinking and certain types of behavior, but more importantly, show the gaps. So I've used it with senior leadership teams involved in science. So in the medical devices arena, you know, show me the numbers. But even that produces its own challenges, because the worst thing you can do sometimes for people is put numbers in front of them, because they then get very curious about the numbers that they have, and they spend more time on, so explain this number to me, and why is this correlation that? And why? Well, I don't think that's a correlation. And I come down to, I worked with one particular team, and the conclusion I drew there was, I appreciate your curiosity and that's valuable, but there comes a point where the platform is on fire and you're not going to sit there and you're going to say, I wonder what the rate of change of speed of the flames is across the surface area of the platform. Or yeah. What's the height of the flames? And how hot is it getting? It's like, no, the platform's on fire. There's enough information there for you to know that actually you need to move out of the way of the fire or do something differently, rather than examine and navel gaze the numbers to go, I wonder if it's the right time for us to move. And yet what's really interesting is there are so many organisations caught up in that pattern of, should we move? Should we not move? And yet to an outsider, sometimes it seems that the issue is so obvious, it's hard to understand at times why people don't get it. And then you go, okay, so what stories are running here? What narratives are running here? What agendas are running here? And who does it serve, most of all, for this status quo situation to exist? So that's the kind of challenge I'm dealing with. And you know, it's teams that want to align, teams that have lost their spark. It's like, how do we get back on track? How do we align better? How do we get more social coherence around the thing that we're trying to do as a team, the output that we're trying to create?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, like you say, Paul, it's all about having a conversation. You know, I think any framework generates different kinds of data. Some of it's numerical, some of it's, you know, represented on some kind of chart or graph or whatever. And others are, you know, telling stories or whatever it might be that the particular framework generates. And what's really important is that, you know, we can surface or share data that is really useful for us to change something, you know, whether that's based on our preferences as an organization or you know, trusting that actually going to come in and do something very different that will shift things when they're particularly stuck. I think, you know, it's important to have a variety of different approaches, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And the key thing is to meet organizations and teams where they are, and to understand what their preferences are, and then to pull out of the kit bag and say, okay, well, if that's your preference, here's an approach that we could try that speaks to that particularly. Or, you know, taking a more numbers-driven approach, here's a different way. But what matters at the end of that, as you've just said, is getting to the conversation that says, how do we move forward? How do we become more regenerative in our approach?
Absolutely.
Well, a few weeks ago, we said we would think about one topic, have one conversation about it, and then share a relevant, simple practice that people can do in their daily lives. So, Asha, what's a team practice that you can recommend, perhaps from one of the frameworks that you've introduced today?
Well, one of the first things I think that teams find really challenging, you know, especially when things are a bit more difficult, is to develop and maintain trust. So I guess there are lots of different ways to do that. And one that often gets forgotten or overlooked, actually, is exchanging regular peer feedback. So not the kind of, you know, stuff when you sit down with your manager and have a yearly or whatever it is, appraisal of your performance, so that's something different. But it can be really super simple things like, you know, thanking people for their effort and their good work and recognizing them to others, you know, both in the team and beyond it. It really works wonders. And then, you know, the more challenging, constructive kind of feedback when something isn't working. And it's not necessarily because there's some sort of technical or operational problem, but there's an issue in, you know, how people are thinking and interacting together as a result. So, you know, I think it's obvious that that kind of conversation is best done privately, preferably informally. You know, maybe it's something that you do over coffee or lunch, whatever. But I always encourage people to start with a simple series of steps, particularly if they're not used to doing this kind of thing. So, you know, first it might feel like a no-brainer, but, you know, prepare for the conversation. So think carefully about why you want to give the feedback, and also what kind of relationship you have with the person that's going to receive it. And then it's a good idea, I guess, to describe what you saw and what you heard, what you said and what you did as a result. So I think particularly when we're trying to develop good team habits around feedback, it's better to only exchange on the things that we've directly experienced ourselves or, you know, witnessed, and not things that other people tell us about, because, you know, it can become gossip really easy, can't it? And then we need to tell the other person about the impacts and consequences of what happened, you know, perhaps including how we felt about it, which in certain cultures, I think, you know, both organisational and national can be really quite challenging. And then it might be a good idea to pause so that both of us can, you know, process and digest the conversation, you know, especially for the person who's actually receiving the feedback. So if it's us who are the recipient, you know, I think it's a good idea to remember that feedback is just always someone else's opinion, even if it feels painful. So I know, for example, I've received feedback from people who, in all honesty, knew quite a lot less about what was going on in shared situations than I did, and the feedback wasn't pretty, you know, maybe for that reason. But it was always an opportunity to learn and grow and actually decide to follow paths that were, you know, much healthier for everybody in the end. And then finally, coming back to the series of steps for, you know, good feedback practice, I think it's a good idea to, or it's wise really, to agree a way forward so that something positive can come for all involved. So, you know, in short, we give constructive feedback so that something can change, so, you know, some kind of action needs to come as a result. What about you, Paul? What practice would you recommend?
Well, I want to build on the idea of feedback, and I want to take a particular practice I learned when I was studying psychotherapy, because actually at a surface level, it really is a different way of looking at feedback. And it's a three-step process called NICAN, which is N-A-I-K-A-N for anyone that wants to look it up. And NICAN has three questions, which is one of the reasons I love it. It's nice and simple. It basically says, It's an art of reflecting, and it says, what did this person do for me? What was it that they did in a way that was helpful? And then the second question is, and what did I do for them? And the third question is the one that's the kicker, which is, how did I make that person's life difficult, and what would I now do differently? And I just love that because the last question is such a trip up, because most people would say, well, I didn't do anything, you know, and what it acknowledges is what responsibility are you going to take for what your part in any blockers that have contributed to a process, you know, what was it that made it go on longer? What was it that caused points of disagreement that actually were semantic and were unhelpful? So I love the idea of NICAN. It's quick to do as well. That's the other thing. So you don't have to sort of carve out a period in the diary. You know, it can be once you've practiced it a few times, you can actually use it very quickly, almost as a water cooler conversation. You can treat it with that lightness if you want. Or take it into more formalised feedback sessions. So that's the one I'd share, NICAN.
Fantastic. I'm going to try that. In today's episode, then, we've talked about why using a framework for team development can be really helpful rather than a model.
And we've introduced three frameworks for different purposes. Asha shared her map, Transform the Collective, for the terrain that many organisations now need to navigate.
Then I shared, or I spoke about my process, learning through doing, for teams who want to step back from their daily business to reflect on how they're creating their reality and what they might want to do differently so that they can begin to traverse that terrain.
And I described how I coach teams to scale leadership using the Collective Leadership Assessment.
We've also talked about some of the challenges that we've seen teams address really well using these frameworks. As always, we'll be writing about these topics in more depth on Substack. You can find Paul's post at the Pocket Dojo and my own at Learning Through Doing. And remember that you can watch or listen to the Pocket Dojo podcast on all your favorite channels and follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.
Join us again in 2 weeks' time for episode 10. The last in the current series, which we'll look back at some of the key things we've explored so far. Series 2, as we hinted at earlier, is going to be about the spaces between us and how we can learn to navigate them well. We'll tell you more about that next time. Bye for now.
See you soon.